So the naturally the generosity principle is this it's like this openness of heart, actually. So giving of the most common principle is say the giving of, say, like physical say things, you know, like say that, you know, what you, as you, as you would understand, say giving physical support to other people, to say religious communities, to charitable organisations. So, you know, you're looking at say physical support on some level or another, but it can even be on the level say of the mind, you know, where we can give say a person time, you know, we can if they need to, say, discuss problems or issues, or give kindness to or compassion to particular individuals, or in, you know, virtually anybody in who comes our way who has a need for that, you know, depending on our own limitations. So the actually the generosity principle, what we, you know, we can actually give in, say, small or medium ways, you know, depending on our own makeup and the attributes and qualities that we have, you know, we can sort of work with this within a comfortable range. Even if we're a person who's like economically, you know, incredibly poor, or even a poor student. So, with but naturally, the actual effect of this, you know, with the, when we're actually develop this, say, generosity, openness of heart, that the actual effect of this on the mind is this like a lightning freeing effect. You know, is this particular say quality gives rise to, say, a sense of, say, lightness and freeing of the mind, a sense of, say, joyfulness and energy to a degree, because it's, you know, you're actually doing performing a good action, you know, usually in relation with other people, or even common animals. So the second principle is the morality parami, and you know, most of you are familiar with the five Buddhist precepts, and for people who are actually committed Buddhists, that they, you know, voluntarily undertake to follow the precepts in themselves as guidelines for you know, behavior, say, in everyday life. So, you know, why do we actually need to have, say, like moral observances as human beings? And we do find, I mean, it's, you know, it's very obvious when we actually look at the state of the world, when we look at the problems and difficulties, the conflict, violence and aggression, which actually can arise between human beings, you know, especially, but actually can arise between human beings and even, say, common animals, and even in between human beings and the state of the planet itself, the effect that we have as a race on this planet. But the most obvious signs, you know, come up in, say, human society. And the guiding principle that we see is that, you know, especially in the newspapers, you know, when naturally most of you have, you know, direct access to television and newspapers on a regular basis, so you actually can see the, say, the core, say, the, like, the lifestyle direction that, say, particular people take, and what actually happens when they follow a particular, say, line of behavior. And you know, we see, you know, so within the Buddhist understanding, that we have this principle that if you undertake say actions which are based in, say, goodness or positivity, that the results will be on that same level. And you know, some people may think that you know, keeping religious observances, maybe a bit sort of fuddy-duddy or old-fashioned, or it's not really, you know, how can you possibly have fun in life, you know, if you keep the five precepts as a Buddhist, but naturally that it's within sila, that sila contains a wisdom component, and if you are able to keep the five precepts on a regular basis and you actually look at yourself, you know, especially on the level of the mind, the nature of your character, the way you feel about yourself, the kind of attitudes you have towards other people, the degree of positivity and energy in the mind, you will actually over time start to see how these precepts work and how they actually, the kind of effect they have on your mind in the long term. And you know, naturally most of you know the precepts, guidelines are, you know, not to to kill living beings, no matter how large or small, not to steal anything which does not belong to you personally, not to tell deliberate lies or misrepresent the truth, and not to engage in illicit sexual activity, and sleeping with other people's partners, and the full range of different behaviours people can get up to, and not to partake of drugs and alcohol, or non-medicinal drugs and alcohol, which actually lead to a clouding of consciousness and a dulling of sharpness and alertness in the mind. You know, because naturally, you know, doing different drugs can be fun in the short term, but especially with any kind of drug that a person might take, there's, you know, you don't get something for nothing. And if we alter one's brain chemistry, one's sensory experience to any degree, that we will have to compensate for this at some point in the future. And people tend to do and say things which they may not be fully aware of, and which may create problems and difficulties for them in both the short and long term. So naturally, this sila, as well, that will be a foundation principle for the development of meditation and wisdom, because for realistically, that people will find it incredibly difficult to go quite deep in meditation if their sila is virtually not rock solid. Because intrinsically, you know, no matter who you are, whether you're a monastic or, lay disciple, that, basically we don't get away with anything whatsoever. You know, you basically become a mirror unto your soul. So any little tricks that we get up to, or maybe unscrupulous or behaviour on any level, that will actually come up for us when we go to sit and walk meditation. We will have to work through that and resolve that particular aspect in the mind. So in relation with this, the number three principle, the wisdom component in the practice, you know, which is really the ultimate principle of Buddhist practice in the long term, and of all the foundation principles that you undertake as a Buddhist person, that the wisdom component is the one which will actually free you on a ultimate level, as far as your experience in samsara, or this repeated process of birth and death that, you know, we believe that we go through. And so all the minor to intermediate principles that we see in the practice, you know, both with sila and meditation, patient endurance, and the different aspects of parami that we develop. That especially in the final stages is wisdom, which will actually free you. But naturally the other paramis are quite essential. I mean, the Buddha would not have made a list of these paramis as actually practice principles to develop unless every single one of these was quite necessary for each individual to basically reach spiritual emancipation, we'll say spiritual realization, and attain the enlightenment stages. So with the this aspect of wisdom, how do we actually undertake that, in day-to-day life? And key principles are that you really need to, within your life, within your mind and body, you need to come to a more profound and deep understanding of who you are as a person, because naturally with the process of Dhamma, especially meditation, actually going into your personality or character, that you are going to basically you're going to have to work through an incredible amount of personal stuff, right across the range, all the loves and the hates and the jealousies and everything else which every single one of us has. You will have to work through all that, and you may see different things, different emotional states may come up at different times in your life. Some people may never even see a trace of jealousy, maybe in the first 5 years of practice, and then after that point it starts to come up, and that particular emotion that's part of the karmic process of, as you move into your nature through Dhamma, through meditation, that you have to work through and really come to a very deep comprehension of these experiences, and take this understanding to a level where you're able to actually to release yourself from them in an ultimate sense. Because if you have any sense of real attachment or clinging to these experiences, these emotional experiences, which are all part of our ego, this sense of self that we have and that we tend to hold on to quite firmly at times, that ultimately that these thoughts, ideas, views and feelings have to be let go of as time goes by, as the months and years roll by, that you need to basically relinquish, you have to surrender your ego in the long term if you want to basically reach the goal either in this lifetime or say the next couple of lifetimes, because it's this ego, this sense of self, which is the principle, the pivot pin, which actually keeps you in this cycle of birth and death. So as you slowly relinquish the ego, slowly relinquish the ego, develop one's intuitive understanding, that one will ultimately shorten the potential for rebirth in the future, even if you don't attain to, say, the enlightenment stages in this life or the next life. As far as the big picture is concerned, that by basically clearing house, emptying the mind of all one's both, say, physical and mental attachments, that you reduce this this like vast reservoir of let's say of desires of attachments, which will, you know, bring you back to rebirth in high and low realms in this universe of ours. So with the wisdom component and the preceding factors, that we, in order to develop the path, that we have to, say, put forth a degree of, say, effort, exertion in the practice, because naturally if we don't make any, say, underlying effort whatsoever with the path, that how can we expect to get anywhere whatsoever? And naturally this level of effort that needs to be made is both on the level of, say, the body and the mind, and but naturally the mind is the key principle for success in the the understanding and the realization of Dhamma. And so naturally, where will this energy become manifest? How do we actually put forth effort on the level of the mind? So if we look at our foundation principles, that we can put forth effort into maintaining the right moral observances with the five precepts to watch over, like our intentions on a surface to subtle level, as we do things on a day-to-day basis in our life, that in order to keep good sila, that you actually have to watch over and guard yourself quite closely. This word we call guarding may sound a little bit over the top, but it's quite realistic in the sense that one has to, say, protect the qualities of the mind that you actually have developed up to this point, and actually increase the quality and the strength of these principles in the long term, because naturally with sila relates directly with karma, the generation of good and bad karma, and by observing good sila, that you maximize one's wholesome karma and minimize the bad, and just makes your spiritual journey a bit easier. You won't have to work through so much chaff and so many difficulties and problems. If you're able to follow the five precepts as a training in itself. So naturally, this aspect of energy would underlie the application and the development of all the parameters in the system. But you will put forth that energy, whether it's mental or physical, in different ways, which will be connected with the quality of that parami. But naturally, when we look at the overall sense of the system, so with meditation, the sila, meditation, and the development of wisdom, that each person with their own, their own personality and character will be able to work their practice in a way which is suitable and of of the most, see most benefit to them. So, essentially, with patience, say for example, with this next principle of patience, the Buddha in himself called, say, patience, or the Pali word Kanti, he called it the highest of the austerities. And so, why is this particular aspect of patience so necessary in the system of Buddhist training? And because realistically, that this practice that we undertake, is not a piece of cake. It's essentially, if you really do this practice, it's realistically, it's hard work, and but if you've got this attitude that even though things get a bit tricky or things get a bit tough, that on an ultimate level, that one keeps one's eye on the prize, and in the back of one's mind, regardless of whether one's monastic or lay disciple, that this will be the highest principle that you aim for in life. Naturally, you have your partners, your children, your careers, but on the highest level, this is what you are aiming for. You've got a certain time span to work with. Like every single person in this room, there's no guarantees exactly how long you will live. There will be people in this room who will not be here. They could be gone within the next 12 weeks or even 12 months. They could live out the full lifespan to 70, 80 or even 90 years of age, depending on their personal karma, the way, the kind of lifestyle they live, the kind of attitudes they have. There's many, many factors involved with the longevity of human beings. But we need to develop this attitude that if we consider ourselves to be committed Buddhists, that we are, we're not prepared to waste, say, too much time, basically just maybe just possibly even just like playing around in life and getting involved in things which are completely fruitless or a waste of time. Naturally, this is sort of slightly tainted with from the monastic perspective. This is only my personal perspective. I've got this kind of attitude, but in life, you find that if you want to develop yourself as a Buddhist person, you have your own personal life, one's family, one's work, and whatnot, which is fine, which one can still it's still workable, even if one is a business person. One can still develop oneself as a Buddhist. It just takes a little bit more nous, a little bit more maybe insight to actually work the practice in different ways, say like mindfulness training and keeping good speech. Even though if things get a bit tricky, you're working with people who cannot be trusted, you can't trust their word, or they might take advantage of you or things like that. You may need to work your practice in a certain way in relation with the kind of work that you undertake. But naturally, as far as the big picture is concerned, that you're looking at, say, like lifetimes of effort. So even in order to reach the first enlightenment stage. This quality of patience will give you that underlying resilience and resolve to play the game come what may. It's just like a loose term. So you're prepared to undertake to train yourself at whatever level is comfortable for you, and regardless of what comes your way or what you have to go through, that you will not basically you will hold your ground. You will not throw in the towel and actually compromise yourself as far as, say, foundation principles in practice are concerned. And because naturally the whole system of Buddhist training, you know, it's like, you know, constantly facing one's nature, facing one's likes, dislikes, you know, being tempted, being possibly compromised by other people, you know, like our sila may get compromised, or we get caught in, tricky situations where we may have to compromise our personal standard. But if you really feel that this path is worthwhile, is something that you are prepared to give your life for, that you will do your best, you know, not to, to do things which will really, you know, sort of create major problems or difficulties for you in the short or long term. And because you find that, you know, the whole system, you know, the reason why, say, patience is so valuable, because in the long term, over lifetimes, that will be one of the major underlying forces which will allow you to almost like virtually like endure, in a sense, whatever comes your way, and you will come to an understanding of that experience. It could be any level of suffering that you could think of, you know, all the, say, incredible joys and happiness that we can experience in one's life. But, you know, naturally all these conditions are changeable. You know, we will have to pass through, say, the full range of one's experience as a human being. And when you contemplate, especially on the level of the three characteristics, you don't need to, I mean, naturally the aspect of, say, suffering, unsatisfactoriness is a major principle of the teaching on an ultimate level. You know, once you reach the enlightenment stages, that you will see the big picture, and you will know directly on a profound level that everything else that you see, you know, even incredibly deep, refined states of meditation, are essentially suffering. Because for the person who actually attains to the Nibbana element, you know, that is the actual pinnacle of, say, spiritual development of realization, and that everything else before that point is of no comparison. It cannot, nothing else that you can experience before that point can be compared with, you know, say, the only stating what the masters have said, that when you pass through the conditioned phenomenon in life, you know, the full range of one's experience, and you attain to the unconditioned, the Nibbana element, then you will understand intuitively and directly what the Buddha taught to a very profound level. And this is the reason why, you know, so for the Sotapanna, they actually break those first three fetters, you know, the personality, you know, the personality view, you know, viewing the personality as self, as a an enduring entity, and actually doubting the teaching and the attachment to, say, wrong rites and rituals, which are not the true path to the goal. So the next principle is, say, truthfulness. And so with this principle of truthfulness, you know, naturally as in speech, that we make efforts to align ourselves, say, with the truth principle in relation with speech between ourselves and other people. And so naturally this speech component, this you know, sort of observing or say speaking the truth, you know, can be taken on a number of levels. And say on the most, say, blatant and obvious level, that this relates directly to, say, the telling of say, like, out and out, say, like, lies, and you know, like, say, like, misleading people, maybe even possibly for personal gain, you know, for some maybe some underlying purpose that you want to deceive another individual. You may want to impress them, you may want to inspire confidence in that person, get them on your side, or, you know, there's many, many different, say, emotional, psychological little tricks and methods that we may use to, in this particular way, like deceiving another person. So that's the most blatant, say, expression that we see. And if we take a bit at the say the medium, it's like in the medium range, where we may, just through, even through lack of mindfulness, we, in everyday speech, because speech is quite, in general conversation, we can talk quite quickly, and sometimes we can't actually track ourselves and actually you know, see which way our mind is going, the actual direction, what the quality of our intention is. And we may actually speak faster than we can actually follow the intention of our mind, what we're actually aiming at. So, you know, we can make the sort of little slips in speech, we can overestimate the truth, you know, we can tell almost like, you know, we sort of like eating like unconscious lies, not deliberately, but, you know, just basically sort of, you know, almost like tripping ourselves up in a sense, where we speak so quickly that we lose our sense of the reality principle, you know, actually aligning our verbal contact with, you know, with how we, you know, say, with the reality principle, the way we relate to others. And actually the another level of speech that we see is, say, for example, like, say, like white lies, and we may you know, we may need to actually say, to tell white lies in day-to-day life on an irregular basis, sometimes as a necessity. So, for example, if you were a doctor or a therapist, or say even like a registered nurse in the hospital system, that you may not be able to be so blatant and tell people exactly, you know, what's going on, or tell them the truth of a particular situation, or what their, maybe their diagnosis, or, you know, what their, you know, maybe what's something in relation to their personal life. You may have to actually protect that person, or maybe even mislead them in small ways, because sometimes emotionally some people, especially if they're emotionally fragile, they could be incredibly physically sick in the last weeks of terminal cancer, that you may not be able to hit them with this almost like a sledgehammer approach, to tell them exactly what's going on. You may have to sort of soften the blow a little and speak to them in a way, which is not completely true, which may sort of hint at the truth, but it's not like 100%. But you have to consider the emotional makeup, the needs of that person. They may not be ready to hear that at that point in time. So the next principle is the determination, the what we call adhitana parami. And the nature of the adhitana parami is where one makes a resolve, this determination to possibly achieve, say, certain, point their mind in a certain direction, achieve certain goals or results, realistically in the short or long term. And the underlying principle with this is that naturally, as a person, human being, that you have a awareness of your strengths and weaknesses, and you may, especially if you have a strong ego in a sense, that you may feel this desire to actually make determinations or goals in relation with, could be not only spiritual life, could be business relationships, this and that, and you are aiming to improve or better yourself in some way. And so this sense of adhitana is that you develop this attitude where you lift the mind up, you develop this mindset, this attitude where you seek to improve or better yourself in some some principle in life. You can use adhitana in the full spectrum of experiences or activities in life, professional sports people, may do that. People in business, they may seek to aim, develop higher goals and aspirations. So with the sense of adhitana, that realistically it's got to be realistic. It needs to, for the person who makes a personal determination, say with spiritual life, where even things like they've got a very hectic lifestyle, incredibly busy, and even just to sit quietly for 5 minutes, in meditation, it's not something which they can do with ease, but they make an adhitana where they just slight adjustments with one's personal family life, just so they can, just put aside 5 minutes, go to sit in a quiet room and practice meditation for 5 minutes, and reflection in daily life. And so those goals, they need to be realistic and achievable, because if one, within oneself, if one aims too high, if one aims beyond the capacities of oneself, that one may not come anywhere near one's aspirations. One may even possibility of failing miserably, one may feel disappointed, discouraged, and you know, it doesn't do one any good as far as one's like personal confidence goes in the long term. So each person, you know, needs to to look at themselves honestly. What can I actually say achieve? Maybe say over even like 12 months. You know, like I might work on increasing my meditation the time I sit, or maybe just a bit more careful with precepts, or you know, say putting energy in with everything I do in daily life, you know, to put effort in and, you know, sharpen one's personal mindfulness, and to actually reflect on, you know, principles of Dhamma when one actually undertakes a course of action in life. You know, one watches quite closely, you know, the cause and effect principle to see if one's the direction that one points one's mind at a particular time, you know, does it give rise to good results, you know, say like, you know, reasonably wholesome good qualities arising, you know, say in the short or long term, because realistically that's what we aim for, to you know, to develop goodness and to refrain from evil and to slowly purify the mind over a number of years and over a number of lifetimes ultimately. So with the ninth principle of loving kindness, so naturally loving kindness is an incredibly useful practice, and it's like metta, like a tree in a sense, where you the trunk. When you're developing metta, the trunk of the tree is like metta, but metta just branches off and can just touch so many other areas of your life. And, you know, I mean, why does this occur? You know, why does metta, you know, this sense of loving kindness, goodwill towards oneself, especially, and towards others? Why is this? How do we develop this principle, and why is it useful in one's life? So when we, you know, as most of you are familiar with, that we, with the practice of metta, we develop the, especially the beginning to the intermediate level, we have these like formulas, these like mantra formulas, you know, say like, may I be, say happy, successful, positive. We radiate this positive feeling towards ourselves, and you know, naturally, you know, metta, it's a an emotional state of mind, and you know, to really, especially with the first three Brahma Viharas, and you know, they are very much emotional states, and with metta we begin with ourselves, because essentially we are the most important person, because as far as life goes, everything comes from us. As Krishnamurti said in one of his books, like, we are the world. So as you develop yourself as a person, as you develop increasing say positivity, joyfulness and friendliness within your own mind, that will radiate out and affect others, you know, affect your friends, partners, your workmates and associates, and that this sense of metta, it has with within itself as a state, we can choose the words, the kind of feeling, the kind of wrong mood that we want to develop. You know, we can choose the words which are actually important to us. You know, we can support ourselves emotionally with metta practice. And but as most people find, even when you develop for yourself, it moves out to other people quite quickly. You know, even when you suffuse yourself only, even over years and years, that it naturally moves out from your being and moves out towards others. And so the Buddha stated, you know, the 11 qualities of metta practice, the ones that we see most obviously, is the you know, the sense of, say, friendliness, positivity, goodwill that we develop in the mind, that the person with metta has a degree of, because of the underlying positivity and joy and happiness to a degree, as time goes by, especially over like weeks and months, because it, you know, it is as a practice in itself, of all the practices, it is the fastest of practices in order to actually see results. And you know, people usually see it within, especially family members, they see the change in the person easily within 3 or 4 days. And the attitude of the particular individual towards others. And so the person with metta has a degree of, say, like, it's almost like like an underlying protection against negative states, say, like anger, irritation, jealousy, and say, like even very strong states like hatred will give you a almost like a buffer, like a boundary in a way against very, very like negative, harmful states of mind. If we've got that underlying metta, will take the edge off just like general negativity. And the person with metta, because of generally the attitude, they tend to be liked by, you know, both human beings and naturally even like common animals. And even, you know, for any person who actually comes into the monastery, a person who practices metta, they do find that you know, they can get much closer to the say, for example, the small creatures and the kangaroos in the monastery. And you know, because people may think animals, not necessarily in Buddhist circles, but, you know, people may think animals are, you know, are dumb creatures, but they're quite intuitive, and they feel energies, especially with, you know, human beings, because they, you know, even kangaroos, they're well aware of the potential for human beings to actually kill and harm. And they do come into the monastery for safety. And even around my kuti, you know, I can almost like reach over some nights, you know, get a kangaroo, like kangaroos just out the front door there, and you can almost even like reach over and touch them. They're very, very trusting, and there's very little fear. Even when you put like water, it's a bit almost like food. If you put food out for them, they just go for you straight away. But even water, they just move in very, very close, quite fearless. So naturally, with the increased energy and the positivity that you have with metta, that you the person tends to find that they, you know, within the, say, like the meditation practice, increases energy for practice, reduces the power and the effect of the 5 hindrances, which are the obstacles to concentration or samadhi practice. You know, to that effort to just gently, you know, like still the mind over time. And usually most people find that their meditation, you know, improves like 100% if they do metta for at least, you know, 1 or 2 minutes beforehand. And that positive quality tends to endure for, you know, like up to 24 hours for most people. Fall asleep much more easily when the mind's less disturbed, the mind's, say, comfortable. and at ease, you know, the person tends to go into the sleep state much more easily. And when they do sleep, the sleep is more restful. So for example, if you get whatever it is, 5 hours, 5.5, or 6, that the quality of the sleep tends to be better. And because of the underlying energy, one doesn't tend to have, say like nightmares and bad dreams. And the Buddha stated, you know, naturally with metta, you get this, there's a degree of protection against, say, like fire, weapons and poisons. And I have seen examples of that, you know, in Thailand. So the last principle of the 10 is equanimity. And this sense of equanimity in practice is virtually like this state of emotional balance or stability. And the reason why, say, equanimity develops over the years, you know, I mean, you don't see incredible equanimity over, say, like maybe a number of months. You know, I mean, if you to see solid equanimity, you know, you're looking at, you know, 3 to 5 years for most people, because you know, when you actually work through your personal stuff in the practice, you know, you work through both, say, both positive states, you know, states of happiness, negativity, maybe anger, irritation, and the rest, that through the process of, say, reflection and investigation, you know, developing an increasing understanding of your experience, you know, the key principle, that especially with the three characteristics, you know, you come to a full emotional, intellectual understanding of what you're going through, and then you label that experience. So, for example, if it's within the within a negative parameter, you know, this particular experience is a degree of suffering on one level, and this experience is changeable, you know, which nobody can argue with. It's a reality principle. And this experience is ultimately empty. If it's changeable and I can't control it and it comes and goes, that, you know, ultimately at the highest level, it is empty phenomena. And when you use these three, especially, you know, both the formal investigation and then you label each experience, whether it's joyful or absolute misery, with the three characteristics in some sense which is comfortable for you, you don't need to focus on suffering so much, because you may develop this attitude that life is basically a complete misery and not much fun at all. But if you focus more on changeability and emptiness, the effect is much more neutral in a sense, the way you feel it. And so through that process of formal investigation and the application of the three characteristics, that when the mind like understands and comprehends what you're going to increasing levels, increasingly deeper levels over the years, that the mind understands and relaxes and lets go of this phenomena. And you develop this sense of virtually emotional balance and detachment, because you see, instead of like being like an emotional yo-yo, where one's mood just continually just goes up and down, or, you know, like a person has the ability to press your buttons on a regular basis and you respond to this over time, that one gradually frees one's mind and one is not at the say the mercy in the strong in it, you know, to maybe too strong a word, but no, one's not like say like a puppet on a string and at the mercy of say like external internal forces or energies. One has this sense of say like distance or say space between oneself and that experience. So naturally, in conclusion, with this system, this training system of the 10 paramis, that you know you will develop them to varying degrees in your day-to-day life, and it's actually worth keeping them in the back of one's mind, because you can opportunities will arise where you can apply some quite strongly, maybe more than others, and because all the efforts that you make in these areas will they're just like almost like say the wealth in your spiritual piggy bank. So all these very very small efforts that you make, these things that you do in life, you know, especially in relation with the path, it all counts. And you know, at the end of the day, you know, you can reflect back, and you know, you can see that you know, you have improved in some small ways. And when in the long term, the big picture, when it comes time for you to actually leave this body and for your consciousness to go on to another life with your karma, that you will have maximized your say storehouse of wholesomeness and good karma, which you will take to your next life. So I will finish it here and hand over to our president.